Hello to my Child Health Advisory Council members. It's good to see you today. As you know, we're going to prepare to talk openly and just kind of candidly about some important topics in pediatric academic leadership development. And this pediatric insight conversation today is going to focus on the topic of recruiting and retaining top talent and K-Award recipients. So I'm really thrilled today to be with Bruder Stapleton, Renee Jenkins, Arnie Strauss, Craig Hillemeyer, Christine Gleason, Bob Swan, and Danielle LaRocque-Arena. Our panel is made up of individuals from all sorts of areas of pediatric medicine, neonatology, nephrology, cardiology, pediatric surgery, developmental pediatrics, epidemiology, public health. So we're real broad in terms of our disciplines and also broad in terms of our academic leadership roles as chairs or former deans or division chiefs or our research scientific leaders in research institutes. So we have a lot of individuals with different perspectives on K awardees. So it should be an interesting conversation today. So thanks for everybody for joining. So just by way of kind of general, you know, what is a definition of protected time that is required for K awardees? I think most people know what that means. It's essentially taking a young individual who's going to develop an academic career and protecting them from the reality of putting their effort towards generating revenue, which in academic pediatrics is most commonly clinical revenue. And it's protecting them also from educational requirements for their appointment and also administrative roles. And for most individuals and most institutions, the amount of protected time, definitely for a K award, varies from 70 to 80%. But protected time can be given in many academic settings, even those that are not required, you know, as part of a K commitment. And I think that making that kind of investment in individual is an investment that is made essentially in a collaborative way between the candidate and the institution, because the institution is going to be funding not just the salary. Oftentimes they'll be funding research supply money, additional travel, course curriculum that might be required, master's degrees. There's a whole variety of investments that are made to make sure that that protected time realizes the goal of really having a successful academic career. And from the candidate, you really expect the commitment, the dedication to using that time effectively, that they go into it really well prepared with their mentorship plan. And, you know, that partnership then hopefully at the end of 2 to 5 years, which is generally what most individuals will find, will lead to a successful independent career and funding. So let's just talk really generally. Arnie, maybe I can invite you and Renee and others. Tell us a little bit about your experience and the pressures and the perspectives that you've seen when you've been dealing with the development of a young K awardee during your careers.
Thank you, Valerie. So I want to emphasize a couple of words that you mentioned. One is mentorship, because that's what K awards are supposed to be. And the other is expectation. And the third is communication. So mentorship is absolutely critical to the beginning of both the recruitment and the retention of a aspiring physician scientist. So that creating that environment of mentorship, supporting that mentorship, whether it's you yourself, the person who is recruiting the faculty member, or some other individual, is really critical in my view. And it can't be part-time. It has to be all the time. It can't be sort of half-baked, it needs to be all in, because most young faculty members don't have a really good idea of what's going to be required to be successful in that independence investigative career. So creating the right mentorship and supporting that mentorship, including especially for the department chair, including one's own time, I think is critical. The word expectation, I think, is bilateral. That is, what are the expectations that you, the department chair or division director, have for the faculty member, and what are their expectations from you in terms of support? And to me, it's very helpful to develop those and potentially write them down not always in great detail, but enough so that there's a very clear understanding. Many young faculty members don't realize that those expectations are bilateral. So for example, when I was recruited as chair, I wrote down, this is what I think needs to be done, and this is what I'm willing to commit to do. And if the faculty candidate writes that down, then they will realize that what their commitment is. And hopefully that will help develop the partnership. It's another one of your good words, Valerie, partnership about the future. And that communication to me is really critical, because if a young faculty member is left to their own time and devices, they may not anticipate what those how those expectations can be fulfilled. So communication about expectations and mentorship to assist people in getting those done, to me, were the critical lessons that I learned in recruiting and retaining K recipients.
Renee, could you give me some of your perspectives?
First of all, Arnie's points were very well taken, especially the issue around the requirement for mentorship. But I think what we also do is introduce the awardees to research networks so that they recognize that there are colleagues like them at other institutions, and that we make those connections for them so that they have a wider breadth of approaching their research. So I think the research networking is very important. Also, mentorship training. I think we tell people that, you know, we want them to be mentors, but we aren't as explicit as we need to be in terms of that. And I know that we sent a couple faculty members to a summer program on being a mentor so that it was really firmly structured, so that they're not, you know, everybody's idea of mentorship is not the same. And so it's helpful to have some formal training for especially early career researchers to know what they really should be doing as strong mentors. So I think those points are important.
So if I could just follow up on that last one, Danielle, you might want to make a few comments, because oftentimes in the senior offices of the dean, and maybe Craig too, you as well, there are programs that medical schools and institutions, universities develop in just these areas that Renee is talking about. And it's funny how few people either A, know about them and seek them out. So maybe you both could make some comments about that.
Yeah, no, thank you. First of all, I agree with Arnie's comments and Renee's, and very thoughtful process of recruiting and being committed to the success, either a freshly out of training faculty or early career or early mid-career. And they may be very different considerations. So a couple of thoughts. Is that I think, you know, the K-12 or other things that allow folks to get another degree, either an MPH or a master's in clinical research, is often available in some institutions that have CTSAs, CTSIs, et cetera. And making folks aware of those very early on, I think, is critical. But actually, as I was listening to Arnie and Renee, one thing popped out at me is that the choice of the research area is so critical. Okay. And you said lessons learned. Maybe I can draw from my own experience when I was a fellow, as RWJ fellow at CHOP. I had been a chemist. I wanted to do work on calcium status and lead poisoning, et cetera, et cetera. And I did choose the first faculty position where I had no mentors, even though I argued hard for time for research, which at the time was unheard of. So I think one of the conversations that's really critical in terms of, and Renee's point about research networks, it's actually not only research networks, but it is to have the content mentors that actually could help guide you. And I say this in terms of health services research, for example, or topics such as gun violence, which are topics that have not traditionally been supported as much as basic science, that you really need to establish that communication if you're recruiting that individual to commit to, you know, their choice of topic, first of all, and then to have them identify mentors both, and I think you'll get to this later, both internal mentors and external mentors that could help grow their career.
Craig, your comments or thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think oftentimes leaders forget that they have a real advantage in being able to speak about something. And by the very fact that they talk about it, it tends to make it important. And so leaders should take advantage of those opportunities to emphasize the importance of mentorship in dealing with young investigators. I also think that there's a real opportunity to take examples of successful mentorship and to point them out, to point out how young investigators have been able to take advantage, and not just to applaud the success of the young investigator, but also to point out how the mentor played an important role, because oftentimes mentors, especially younger mentors, don't really know how to go about being a successful mentor. And so those types of conversations can oftentimes be helpful in promoting successful mentorship programs.
These are all great points. All right, let's get down to brass tacks. It's time to write that offer up. It's trying to put those specifics into the plan so that the candidate will be successful and everybody knows what's being committed by the candidate and by you. So Chris, I'm gonna ask you to make some comments. You've been on the front lines doing this quite a bit. And Bruder, maybe you too could make a few comments around creating the structure of an offer that'll be successful.
Well, in addition to, you know, all of the commitments and expectations for protected time, mentorship, the support, which may not just be in mentorship and so forth, but, you know, financial, salary support, you know, what are those kinds of things, laboratory assistance, you know, having a clinical research nurse, for example, be available, are all important things that fit into, you know, what Arnie said, it's a two-way street, right? So, you know, what does the person need? What's expected of them if you provide this? And in what period of time, I think, need to be important parts of the offer letters and so forth. I think one thing that to me was very important as a neonatologist, and I would say probably this is true for nearly all of the subspecialties in pediatrics, maybe especially too for like pediatric surgery. You know, I think it's important to be very specific about what you truly mean by protected time. And by that, you know, it's one thing to say, well, you're going to have 75% of your time protected from administration, education, clinical. But then it's like, well, what does that mean in neonatology? So that brings up, well, what's a full-time clinical FTE in your division, in your department? What's the denominator? You know, how are you dividing up the pot? And that to me, not being as specific as you can be about that, either asking the questions from the candidate's point of view or in recruiting, you have to be able to, you know, you have to be honest and say, well, it's a moving target. We don't really know what a clinical FTE is in our division, or we're making strides to, you know, improve this, or, you know, whatever. But somebody, you know, somebody who is expecting that 25% of their time will be given to their clinical obligations. And it turns out that 25% time is, you know, attending for, you know, 16, 18 weeks in the NICU and a level four, and then doing some outreach. It's like, well, you know, that's not going to be very good for retention. And it's not really, it doesn't meet anybody's expectations, really. So I think that's an important thing that has to be considered. Not that you have all the answers, but you have to be honest and transparent about what you truly mean by you're going to have 75% of your time protected, and over what period of time. How is that going to change during the course of the K award, and what's going to happen if they don't advance to the next level, if your expectations of them as a chief or a chair are not realized, what happens then? What do they step into?
Chris's comments were spot on. And, you know, I think one way to address, aside from the FTE questions, but one way to address this, the clinical obligation, is to also make sure that there's mentorship in their clinical realm. I think it's especially important for someone who's devoting 70 or 80% of their research time to make sure that when they are clinically active, that they're successful in maintaining their skills. So I think having a clinical mentor who may be very separate from the research mentor is a very important thing. The other ingredients to success that I've seen are if you can clearly define the times of clinical obligation. You know, if it's this person is in the lab, can fill in as needed, it becomes difficult for them to control that part of their life. So, you know, both for protecting their research capacity, but also, again, making sure they're successful clinically, especially early in their career. And then lastly, you know, this, I don't have any answers to this dilemma, and I think it's not unique to surgery. I think it's an issue for many of the more highly compensated specialties in all of pediatrics. And that is the gap, the funding gap between, you know, 20% or excuse me, 70 or 80% of an FTE for a highly compensated specialist is likely far greater than what the NIH salary schedule is. So, you know, it's imperative to have some source of either departmental or institutional resources that can offset some of that. I don't have an answer to that. I know some institutions have been great using endowments for that, but it is a real challenge in the more highly compensated specialties.
I was reflecting on both recruiting outside candidates and internal candidates, and both share similar needs, but you know, when you recruit an external candidate to your department or division, it's really important that you do have the infrastructure available to provide them that time. In other words, if you have a very large clinical load for your, whatever your division is, for instance, very few faculty, is it really right to recruit somebody into that environment? I think you have to be really fair. And secondly, both internal and external K candidates may not get their, they may not have their K, they may have applied. And you really need the resources if someone is a really promising investigator and you're committed to that, to be able to tide them over till they actually get that K award. And one mistake that some people, I think, make is that, well, that person doesn't have the K, so we'll just give them to pay their salary a little more clinical time while they're preparing the K. And that's a very failed strategy, because they very need that research time to get that K. The second thing is creating the mentorship doesn't necessarily have to stay in your department. We found, you know, it really is helpful to know and important to know the scientific community and find the best mentor. We used, when we were building our research programs, a lot of people in the Department of Medicine and basic science departments who are very generous and really great mentors, and actually are more strict about the clinical time sometimes than we pediatricians are. And finally, having peer mentors, the networking that Renee mentioned, having an internal K club like we had, where the K awardees get together on a monthly basis. There's a repository of successful K grants that they bring in their own questions and mentors and bring in speakers for gaps and what their own programs have is really a very helpful thing. And finally, it's hard to recruit someone with a K award if you don't have a strategy for supporting them as they transition to our awards. People, you know, K awardees are smart, and they know you may not get that R award right at the end of your K. And so do you have a mechanism for bridging? I think all those things are important. Thanks, Valerie.
Yeah, well, thanks for directing the conversation to externals, because that's another topic we wanted to really hit on today is, you know, recruiting an individual who's got established their K award at another institution. And now both for their career development and your interests of your institution, you're recruiting them to your institution. So Craig, do you have any comments on that? Because that oftentimes, as Bruder alluded to, really requires some high level negotiations.
Yeah, I think that the most important thing is to make sure that we emphasize the success of the candidate, because we all know that the success of K award recipients in turning in independent investigators is not as high as we'd like to make it. And I think that emphasizing that in discussions with, say, internal candidates is a really important way of making them understand that you have experience and know how to help them be successful. Obviously, for internal candidates, I think you have a real advantage. They oftentimes have identified a mentor. They've obviously been successful in putting together a K award in the environment that they're currently in. And that can oftentimes be something that you can build upon in terms of trying to create an attractive package for those people. The idea of having them talk with other K award recipients at that institution who've transitioned to a degree of independence and R awards and the like after the K award is a very helpful thing to do. And oftentimes with internal candidates, you're more able to do that. It's easier to do and you're more successful. But I would also want to emphasize that this success of the candidate is the most important thing. And in the world of science oftentimes requires that people need to think about relocating to other localities to learn other techniques, to be exposed to other investigations. And I would be, especially with internal candidates, I think it's important to present both the positives and the negatives. There are a lot of, you know, good reasons to stay there, especially if there's good mentorship. But there also might be some good reasons to look elsewhere. I mean, and many times it's easier to establish independence at a different location than it might be at a location where you've been for a long time. So I would try to present a balanced case to, especially to internal candidates who are probably going to be biased to want to stay there and keep all the relationships they already have, both social, academic, professional, and the likes.
That's great. Arnie, do you have any perspectives on this? You've recruited quite a few individuals to over your career?
Yes, I want to emphasize one of the points that was made, which is the environment and the mentor outside of the department or the division. In fact, in smaller to medium-sized programs, that's particularly key because there may not be the right match for the candidate in terms of either their interests or the mentor's expertise. So taking advantage of the rest of the institution, I think, is really, really critical. So my training, for example, was off in a biochemistry department where I spent a couple of years actually not seeing patients, by the way, but also really taking advantage of tremendous expertise. So in clinical research, it's the same thing. Epidemiology and biostatistics can be so important. And that may not be, that expertise may not be available within the Department of Pediatrics. So finding the right environment with the expertise, I think, is critical.
So Arnie, your comments are really tremendous, but you said something that I think we haven't touched on yet. And that is, you said you didn't do any clinical work for 2 years. Oftentimes that is the commitment that the candidate and the institution has to make. And I'd be really interested in, you know, Bob, others' perspectives, because when you're in a technical area like cardiac ICU, pediatric surgery, neonatology, the candidates can oftentimes be very anxious about, you know, not being at the bedside where they really will develop the skills that they'll need long-term in their career. But anyone on the panel want to make a comment about how you reassure the candidates or what kind of strategies you've used to help them to understand the importance of that commitment? Arnie, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, could I just comment about that? So I'm a cardiologist, and yes, there was some concern that I might lose the skills, as Bob mentioned. But in fact, I found it much easier to focus on the research and much easier to be successful doing that. And then when I came back, it was to clinical effort. It was really not that difficult. Things hadn't changed very much. The echoes were still being done in the same way. So I think it's a lot easier than many people anticipate. The way I would often recommend for people I recruited was that they make sure that they have a clinic that's ongoing so they have some continuity of care, but maybe a less intensive inpatient experience.
I think that in some specialties that's doable. My sense is that particularly when you're recruiting candidates from outside, most of them in the surgical fields are anxious to still maintain some sort of clinical practice. So finding that balance, as I said earlier, potentially really compartmentalizing their clinical commitment rather than having it be ambiguous or fluctuating. And one other thought, I think in surgery, at least, the people I've seen who've been most successful are those that have as intimately as possible associated their clinical practice with their research question. If that can be done, then I think they really support each other pretty well. That's not always feasible, but especially if one's doing really basic or translational research. But even there, if it has direct application to your area of clinical expertise, I think they feed each other. The clinical and the research activity support one another.
Tremendous point. So important. So very, very important. So maybe we can now transition to one that would be really not have the same problem with the clinical skill sets, and that's the K99R00 candidate, who most of the time are full-time research. Does anyone have any comments about the structure of those offers or the retention or the recruitment of those individuals that would be a little bit different from the conversation we've had so far today?
The critical aspect for a K99 to an R00 is having that being able to provide a competitive package for the R00. You know, it's the candidates that are coming in, they my experience is they've been further along in the research. They're very likely to succeed, and they have to produce with their K award. But to move to the R00, you have to have the package that's offered to them is evaluated as to whether they receive that continued award. And so even though it's transitioned to independence, you need to have a commitment from the lab they're in that there's going to be support. You have to have the resources to provide them. And I think it's a little different than recruiting for a brand new K award in that, you know, these people absolutely need research infrastructure support. They need a technician. They need, you know, money for their supplies. It's not, you know, left to the mentor and the grant to get them. The department really has to have a strong commitment and has to have has to be ready to offer a good package, because they're very competitive candidates in my experience, and other institutions are quite anxious to recruit people who are moving on to that R00 because they're considered very strong candidates. I don't know what other people think.
See Danielle shaking her head. Arnie, are any other comments?
No, I mean, I agree with Bruder. I think it's a different consideration for the K99 and R00. If you'll allow, I wanted to make a couple of comments with respect to conversation thus far. I think we alluded to it, but that the success rate may not be as high as we anticipate. And one of the things in medicine that we become more sensitive to is the discussion of what's termed failure and the emotional support that's needed for faculty, and that in fact we're on a particular trajectory which they decided, and maybe there was bilateral decision for that, but in fact they've not been successful. You know, the term burnout was a term that perhaps many of us did not have years ago, and in fact we've looked at some pretty dismal outcomes with respect to people's mental health and even rising rates of suicide among health professionals. So that I think what everything we're talking to is how to create a supportive environment. Know that the conversation around failure is built in because it's part of the process. In fact, that's what experimentation is. But that we support individuals in reaching their full potential, whatever that may be. So, this is not the topic for here, but I think it's one that personally I've experienced as a division chief years ago, and that's pretty painful. So that I think we need to pay attention to the health and well-being of our, you know, mentees. And then I think on the website, we can put up some specific methodologies about defining a full FTE. I won't bore you with what I did for 2 years as a chair, but there are methodologies to do that.
Well, I think I'm going to take the lead in saying that, Danielle, thank you for those comments. It's critically important. And I think most of our discussion today has been kind of upfront, you know, your general comments, how you construct an offer letter and so on and so forth, but it does not stop at the offer letter. You must be constantly, as the leader, the division chief, the department chair, the scientific mentors, you must be constantly talking to the candidates and making sure they're on track, that the barriers that are coming in their way are being addressed, that you're knowledgeable about how things are going, so that you hopefully won't end up with a situation where the candidate's not successful or that they're burned out. And I think we all would agree, probably we all could do a much better job of that post commitment interactions with our candidates and scholars and each other. So thank you all very much for a great conversation today, and we'll see you at our next Pediatric Insight.